Good afternoon. Welcome to this afternoon's session being streamed live from Toronto. My name's Nicole Abadi. This afternoon I'll be in conversation with Canadian novelist and poet Anne Michaels about her third novel, Held, published by Bloomsbury in January 2024. I'd like to begin by acknowledging that this land that we meet on today is the traditional land for the Kaurna people and that I respect their spiritual relationship with their country. I also acknowledge the Kaurna people as the custodians of the Adelaide region and that their cultural and heritage beliefs are still as important to the living Kaurna people today. Before I introduce Anne, could you just all please switch your mobile phones to silent? Anne, I wish I could say welcome to Adelaide in person, but welcome to virtual Adelaide. Thank you for being with us from Toronto.
I am so happy we're able to meet in this way and absolutely heartbroken that I can't be with you personally, especially for this book, Held. The ideas in this book are so important to me, and it would mean everything to be able to meet with readers face to face. But thank you so much, Nicole, wise and compassionate Nicole, for doing this session with me, and thank you to the festival for making this possible. I'm very much missing not being able to talk to people directly, and if people would like to write to me, I answer every letter, and you can reach me through my site, annemichaels.ca, has a link to Twitter. You can reach me through the publisher. I really would love to hear from you. If you
hope
like
you're all
to
listening.
Write.
What a wonderful invitation that is. Anne Michaels' books have been translated into more than 45 languages, and her work has been adapted for the screen and the theatre. Her books have won several international awards, including the Orange Prize for Fiction, the Guardian Fiction Prize, and the Commonwealth Poetry Prize for the Americas, and they've been longlisted for many, many others. In 2015, she was awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship, and from 2015 to 2018, Anne was Toronto's Poet Laureate. There are some fabulous reviews of Held out there already. Two of my favourites, Publishers Weekly said, "Each page of this masterpiece has a line worth savouring." And I can attest to that. My own copy of the book has got massive underlinings on absolutely every page. My other favourite, Ron Charles in the Washington Post, called this book one of the most romantic books I've ever read. And as we start to explore the subject matter, you'll see why that was such an insightful and interesting take on the book. Anne, would you like to start by doing a short reading from Held, please?
Thank you so much, yes. I'm just going to read for a very short excerpt, just a couple of minutes. And it's from the middle of the book, and I'm going to end off with the first two sentences from the book. She had made her husband a hot bath. She had slipped into the water behind him and held him. He was so thin now. They had sat drowsily together in the steaming water as they used to before he was ill. In the span of time it had taken for the water to cool, so silently, so peacefully, leaning against her, he had died. His stillness, an inexpressible violation. She knew that she and her husband had had more time at the end than most. She knew it was everything not to die alone, not to be taken brutally by force. She could never explain. She could never imagine a time when she would be able to explain all he was to her. Leah had drawn a blanket over him. She had dressed. She had made room for herself and lain down next to him. What could she give him now? She knew what he would want for her. That stillness might grow to peace. not still, held. We know life is finite. Why should we believe death lasts forever?
Thank you, Anne. Those last two lines are the opening lines of the book. So just to set the scene, Held is made up of 12 chapters about people and events taking place round the globe on the battlefields of France in World War I, in London, Paris, Suffolk and Estonia, amongst others, from 1903 to 2025. It's not in chronological order, but as you read closely, it becomes clear that the chapters and the characters are interconnected and that what you in fact have at the centre of the story is four generations of a family of strong women. Love is central to each story, and many of them are played out either against the background of war or deal with its aftermath. Anne, you have said this about Held. I wanted to explore the effects over time of our inner lives, what is essentially invisible, how moments of comprehension, desire, transcendence, doubt, belief, the longing for meaning, work their transformations decades later. Could you talk a little bit about that, please?
Well, this book very much is interested in all the ways that love continues its work long past the span of a life. And every day writing this book, I ask myself, in these urgent times, what voice might be small enough to be heard? What do we need now? We're used to measuring history by events and actions, but this book wants to assert a different measure for history, the real and powerful effect of our inner lives, as you said, what we believe, what we value, what we love, what we aspire to. So again and again, Held tries to understand what forces bring us to a present moment. And there's a mathematical example of the asymptote where a line heads toward the axis of a graph and it gets infinitesimally close to that axis and then veers off into infinity. Again and again, Held is trying to get at these moments that are so hard to name, just as we cannot identify the moment when we fall asleep or the moment that dusk turns to dark. Yet these moments are precise and profound. So again and again, this book is looking at moments that are overlooked, that are at the heart of the mystery, at the heart of a mystery of a life. And I'm making here the distinction between mysticism and mystery. And it's that profound mystery that Held keeps trying to capture.
And there's a number of themes that run through this book, and sadly we won't be able to go through all of them, but I've just picked a few that I'd like us to talk about. The first I want to talk about is love and desire and the role of fate in the lives of romantic partners, I guess. So right near the beginning of the book it says, desire permeates everything. This book is full of love stories, all described in the most beautiful, lyrical of language. There's John and Helena, the original couple. There's Anna and Peter, Mara and Alan, Leah and her husband, Paavo and Sophia. In each of those partnerships, each of those romantic partnerships, fate plays a major role in bringing those people together. I'm just going to ask you if you could tell us about John and Helena. Tell us a bit about their relationship and the role that fate played in their meeting each other.
Well, they had a wonderful meeting. Helena is on a train, and she thinks she's missed her stop. But most of the time, we get off the train a stop too late. In her case, she gets off a stop too early. It's a rural station. She gets out in the middle of the night, and she sees that there's a pub with an inn very close to the train station. She can see the lights from the pub. And so she decides that rather than sit alone in this quite scary, empty train platform, she will make her way to the pub to wait the many hours until the next train will come in the morning. She sits down at a table. A drunkard makes a beeline for that table. He, the book says, feels all the axial tilt of the earth as he's walking. He sits down opposite her, and immediately his head hits the table, and he's gone. So some people take the man away so he can sleep it off at the back of the pub. And when the man returns, his table has been taken, and he ends up sitting, joining Helena at her table. And she says that at that moment she felt that if he were to sit down, she would be sharing a table with him for the rest of her life. And that's the beginning of their relationship.
I can't wait for all of you listeners out there to read this book, because there's just so much beauty to be found in the language, in particular in the descriptions and of the lovers and what passes between them. There are too many examples to list, but there were a couple I just wanted to refer to. In another couple mad about each other, it says, "It was the vertigo I had longed for always, that there would be no end to my falling, no boundary to knowing and loving another." Then we have Paavo and Sofia in Estonia in 1980, and I think this was almost my favourite line in the book. Paavo thinks about Sofia, who he's just met. "She had a face that made Paavo believe in justice." You are an internationally acclaimed poet. You've been the Poet Laureate in Toronto. I'm wondering, how do you do that? How do you bring to bear your talents and your gifts as a poet to your prose writing? Until this book almost feels like a fusion of the two, of poetry and prose.
Well, for this book especially, I wanted unashamedly an intensity throughout this book. The book is saturated in history, but I didn't want that history to be overt. I wanted it to be just glinting at the edges, glimmering under the surface. The language in the book is so purposeful, as always in everything that I write. And part of that is connected to this ineffability of what I'm trying to get at and to make space for in this world. We need to respect that ineffability, that invisibility, which I'm sure we'll talk about soon together, that needs to be given space and a place, and its value needs to be acknowledged. So, you know, language can bring us just to the verge of what we as a reader then bridge, like lightning rising up from the ground. We bridge that gap with our own experience. So if the language is working properly, that connection can happen, because I'm interested in what the reader brings to the book. I'm interested in making space for what the reader can experience in reading. So that to me is so central. And so the language is very purposeful throughout for those reasons.
And we come to another couple, Alan and Mara, in England, in Suffolk, and we'll work out, I mean, no spoilers here, but we'll work out eventually that Mara is the granddaughter of John and Helena, the couple that we meet at the beginning. Alan and Mara are a really interesting couple, and their story is very central to the book, and I'll come back to more of that later. But Alan is a war correspondent, and Mara is a doctor, and they meet in a war zone, during a war. When they're both back in England together, Alan, who is completely both of them, in fact, are traumatised. Alan particularly by what they've seen. Both of them are finding it difficult to fit back into normal life, to the abundance of it all. But we see Alan using words in terms of how he sees Mara as his shelter, as his refuge. Could you talk a little bit about the redemptive healing power of love?
Well, it's absolutely at the core of this book. Again, I say this often, that we are used to knowing, we don't need to be convinced of the power of violence, the power of horror, brutality. We know what that is. We understand it viscerally. It doesn't have to be proven to us. But the power of love, compassion, empathy, tenderness, we need to keep learning what that is. We keep to need proving that again and again, as if it's gentleness is not as profound as violence, but it is every bit as profound. It is more profound. It is more lasting. And this book wants us to understand the agency of it, again and again, how potent our inner lives are, how potent our aspirations are, our values are. And at this moment in time in history, we need to understand that we are in no way helpless. And a line that comes from Fugitive Pieces, though it isn't only pertaining to Fugitive Pieces, but everything that I've done, is that a man I'm losing my train.
I think I have the quote, Anne. Is it, there is nothing
a man...
Do you
have the quote? Sure. Yes, there is nothing
one?
A man will not do to another, and nothing a man will not do for another. And this is a central truth to me, proven again and again and again throughout history. So in a sense, this is how love operates in this book.
So there's an infinite capacity to love, counterpoint of which is the infinite capacity to do each other harm. The one plays off against the other.
Yes, and one, in the end, is more potent than the other.
And let's move to another concept very much related, the idea of life after death. The opening line of the book, which you read, is, "We know life is finite. Why should we believe that death lasts forever?" The book explores a number of metaphysical concepts, and one of them is this concept of life or existence in some form after death. So one character speaks to her dead husband, I think it's Leah, whose passage you read earlier. She speaks to her husband about the language of the dead, about how he sends her signals. in the form of wind on her face or a bird sitting next to her. We have a later chapter where Marie Curie and her physicist friend Hertha, both women of science, write letters to their dead husbands. And you say at one point, there are so many ways the dead show us that they are with us. Would you like to talk a little bit about that concept of love surviving death and life after death?
Well, it was very, very important to me that this book takes place, part of the book takes place in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and the years leading up to the First World War, because it was a very significant moment in history, a moment that I have not really heard commented on. And that was a moment when, the moment when science began not only to probe the invisible world, but to manipulate it. I'm thinking, you know, X-rays, atomic experiments, eventually, of course, atomic weapons. And this is the moment in which science superseded or took over the narrative of how we view the invisible world. And people, human beings, have had an ancient relationship with invisibility always. And science has taken over our idea, or tried to take over our idea of what the invisible world is, what invisibility can mean, what cannot by its very nature be proven. And also important, of course, is at the time, the First World War, the scale of death of the First World War, and the fact that for the first time, bodies were, in fact, completely disassembled. There was no body to return to the families. And the War Commission, in fact, the closest they could come was to take photographs of the graves and send those to the families. And so, not surprisingly, with a world so completely inhabited, overwhelmingly inhabited by ghosts, there was the rise of spiritualism. Mm. Most understandably. So this book wants to look at the conflation of science and technology as well. They're very separate things. Mm. But the one thing they do share, one of the things they share, is that they both ask, can we, but very rarely ask, should we? Mm. So this sense of the invisible and all the ways that invisibility shows itself in the world, the effects of that invisibility, it's trying to make a claim, this book, for the value of it. Mm-hmm. We need to create, retain a space for what that invisibility means, what it means for something by its very nature not to be provable. Mm.
That was the next thing I wanted to ask you about, this concept of the unseen, the mysterious, the unprovable, and the issue of the battle between faith and doubt. So you have said that one of the questions this book asks is, why can't we accept that there's a crucial meaning and value in what necessarily can't be proven? So some of your characters consider that as he lies wounded on the battlefield, John, right at the beginning, muses that perhaps the most important things we know can't be proven. Alan, Mara's lover, realises faith is a mechanism, just as love is, proving itself by its disappearance. Could you talk a little bit about the battle between faith and doubt, and why it is so important to keep faith and in particular to have faith in the unseen and the unproven.
Well, I think that there are many ways to answer that very good question. I think as a species that perhaps our profoundest insight is our mortality, which no other animal shares as we do, in the way that we do. I think that in these times, faith is energy, faith is a tool, faith is the way in which we carry the future, and it's not a luxury.
No.
I would like to, if I may, read... I don't know if I'm preempting a question from you, but if I may read that passage between Alan and Mara, because it a small passage, it touches on faith, and it really is so central to what this book is trying to say. They have both been in places of witnessing terrible brutality. And maybe I would just, if you don't mind, I might read a tiny passage about witnessing.
Yes.
And then a passage between the two lovers speaking about faith.
Yes.
This is Mara. It did not matter if what she said was too emotionally expressed or told with the voice of an automaton. What mattered was beginning to speak aloud what she had hoped she would never have to tell, and that she had been received and understood. It mattered like Alan's sleeping breath on her skin. And when she told him of the deer that had come into the graveyard as if to read the gravestones that were all that was left of the burnt village, and the water bird emerging so close it pierced the reflection of the boat, when she told them she was absolutely certain of her mother's presence at those moments, in those places of torment and abandonment. It was so they would know that Anna, her mother, had never stopped teaching her how to give her life and give up her life, how to measure friendship in extremity, and mother and child, systole and diastole, how to love when you have nothing left. Alan was turned away from her. His little torch was on. He was writing in the dark. She touched his shoulder. "Are you all right?" he whispered. She had held a gushing aorta in her hands. She had repaired massive damage one step at a time, concentrating on the tiniest parts of complex systems. In the operating room, she would not let herself think of rescue, only of repair. She had learned that from her mother. And this is Alan. Had my witnessing saved a single life? Mara at least knows she has saved lives, even if they did not survive the next bombing or the next. When a child survives a long operation, only to die within an hour when the hospital is blown up, you are surprised to learn that everything matters not less, but more. That, and not the brutality, which never stops being unspeakable, is the single most important thing I have learned. And just this scene between Alan and Mara, very short, but it's very much the heart of the book. And I think the final word in this passage means an incredible amount to me. Do you think it's possible, Mara asked, for good to survive long enough to outlast, to wait, to endure, while evil consumes itself? It was a philosopher's question, a parent's question, a lover's question. Was it a doctor's question? Alan wasn't sure. No, he said. He knew no one could get in or out now. She knew it too. It was a secret between them that they both knew the same failure, that even if they could go back, there or elsewhere, they would not last a day. It would be a kind of suicide. They were no longer ice cold. Would it always feel like failure? They lay beside each other in the dark. Alan knew with all his soul that he loved her.
And
maybe, he said.
Those passages are so beautiful, and you've anticipated the sort of the next few topics that I wanted to get through. Let's talk now about this, the way that you portray so clearly the brutality of war in the most, to use a word that you used earlier, in the most visceral of ways. You know, you are unsparing, properly so, in your description of the brutality of war. And I love the way you use the language of disgust. So when Alan returns from the war, he has to seal off his contagion. Mara, as she talks to her father and Alan about what she's seen and experienced, says how painful that is, but she has to release the infection. And you read a passage that I had wanted to ask you about, what she says after she's told her father and her lover of what she's seen and experienced and some of the horrors. She says, what matters is that she had been received and understood. Why is that so important to her?
That witnessing is, it's the very fabric of our empathy, because it is uniting not only feeling but thinking. Mm. We are addressing another human being who has the choice of either taking on the responsibility of what they hear or turning away. Mm. So that moment, I think, is crucial. Mm. And between the two of them, because they are so intimate, that moment is, of course, incredibly charged. For her to be understood is essential. Mm. But more than that, it is who we are as human beings. Where does our responsibility begin? Where does our responsibility end? This is something we grapple with always throughout our lives, and especially in this world where information is everywhere. It surrounds us, it permeates us. You really cannot very well turn away. Alan says, you know, what good is he doing? What good are his words doing? He has to, the truth, he has to say the truth. He has to go on saying the same nothing, he says. Mm. We need to understand our own relationship to what we know, what is our responsibility. So, you know, it's the same thing with climate change. And I know that you suffer floods and fires there, and we too are in the same situation as the climate alters day by day. Over the course of the summer, the wildfires were burning, many hundreds of miles away from the city of Toronto, but the city was stank of smoke. Mm. We couldn't see anything. You couldn't hear anything.
We had that in Sydney as well. We've had that experience in Sydney as well, yes.
It's unreal. It's so eerie that there's nothing physical has changed. The city looks exactly as it always does, but there was this permeation of smoke. And so you ask yourself, you know, how close does it have to be before we stop turning away, before we stop acknowledging the truth of something? Does it have to be 500 miles away, 200 miles away, across the city, across the street? Do we have to wait until it is our own house burning? So this question of empathy is so central in the book and so central to our times. At what point do we take responsibility for what we know?
And I want to just ask you about that notion that's written most beautifully concerning Alan, who's the war correspondent, about this notion of bearing witness. He sees his task as to write what no one can bear to read. But just to come back to something you said that I've been asking myself, he tortures himself that it's not just enough to shine a light on something to bear witness if it makes no difference. He tortures himself that perhaps what he's done hasn't in fact saved a single life. But I wanted to ask you, what do you think about that? Does that matter? Is the bearing of witness a good in and of itself, as hopefully perhaps spurring people to action, even if you can't actually calculate it in terms of lives saved?
Absolutely, 100% yes. And that is connected to this whole notion of the power of our inner lives and not understanding all the ways in which our inner lives will have an effect in the world. In this case, things, gestures, recognitions, empathy, they resurface decades later. So they make themselves known decades later, a lifetime later. There are so many ways in which how we live matters in ways that we can't even trace. And that mirrors the complexity of how many switch points we have to live through, how many changes before we are brought to a present moment. How many switch points had to occur before Peter and Helena's sit together at that table?
Yes.
I mean, the complexity is awesome. We can never trace it all. But you have to have an understanding that just because we cannot trace those passages, they still exist. They still exist. And so for Alan to be living his life in a certain way, for perhaps his child to understand how to live her life in a certain way, these are invisible passages that keep running through the book over and over and over again, so that we give value to what we desire, we give value to what we aspire to, and our values themselves are crucial.
So, Anne, running through the book, we've talked a little bit before about the power of love and this idea of the redemptive power of love, and you've talked about how it's important to remind people of that because they'll always be aware of and remember the horrors of war. But what you do in this book, as well as love, there are countless instances of hope and of courage. You talked earlier about Anna and Mara, mother and daughter. What we should make clear is both of those are doctors who leave their safety of their homes to go and be doctors in these dangerous war zones. So the book is just filled with examples of kindness, of courage, of hope. And that, I think you're saying, is that that is the counterpoint to the brutality and the hideousness of war. Is that what you wanted to do, to set the two up against each other, with hopefully the scales tipped in favour of goodness, of hope and love and courage and kindness?
I think definitely that we need to see through Alan and Mara, through Peter and Anna, who also worked in war zones as a nurse, that we understand the effect of how they live their lives. Mm. And we also understand the boundaries, what love is capable of and what love makes us incapable of, both those things. And we have the example of, a man who carries teeth in a sack around his neck because they could be the teeth of his son who was killed. He doesn't know whether they are in fact his son's teeth or belong to another victim, but he keeps them close. Mm. So what are we to understand from this? That love, that father's love, was not demolished to the extent that he could not hold sacred, hold dear, that reality of love that he felt for his son.
And the love that survives the son's death.
Absolutely, absolutely. And again, history tells us that we rise from heinous destruction. It has happened throughout human history. And the book is trying to, again, assert this different way of looking at history, that there is a different measure for human history that, yes, runs alongside or in spite of, in defiance of that brutality.
Mm. And you asked this question, which I had here to ask you as my final question, the point where Mara asks Alan, do you think it's possible for good to survive long enough to outlast, to wait, to endure, while evil consumes itself? And I wondered, is that the central question of this book?
That is certainly one of the central questions of this book, yes, absolutely. And Alan's answer, because he loves her, he says no, and then he says maybe. Mm. And there's such profound leap of faith in that maybe. It is a word that is most resonant to me in this book, that maybe. So hard won for him to be able to say maybe.
That comes back to the notion of hope, doesn't it? There's another passage in the story of Sofia and Paavo in Estonia, in Eastern Europe in the early 1980s, when they're fleeing from that sort of authoritarian regime. There's this great line, nothing enrages a tyrant more than hope.
Yes.
Do you like to talk a bit about that?
I like to try and work that statement into any appearance that I give.
Good.
Nothing enrages a tyrant more than hope. Yes. Again, in this central question that I ask myself every day, what voice could be quiet enough to be heard, is very much trying to address that same second question that I asked myself. What do we need now? So this, the notion of hope as something frail or that can be beaten down, I absolutely am staking a claim against that fragility. Mm. Hope is profoundly tough. Mm. We know this from human experience, from human history. We know that it's astoundingly tough. So I think we need to give it breathing space and status. We need to accept that it has that power. Mm. We're in times where of such anxiety, you know, for young people especially, but not just young people, the anxiety, the rate of anxiety has more than doubled since the pandemic. We're talking about a true pandemic of anxiety. And we need to understand that what we carry within us can affect change. Mm. It always has, and it always will.
Mm. I think that's
and a... I was just going to say, we need to embolden and support people who are also in the front line, putting their lives on the front line with that kind of hope. Sorry, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, Anne, I'm sorry. We've run out of time, but that's a really, really wonderful note to end on. That's such a powerful message, the strength of hope, and none of us should ever forget that or doubt that strength. I only wish I could say to people what I usually do at the end of the session, which is Anne will be here to sign these books. Sadly, she won't be, but please pretend that she will be and go and buy this absolutely beautiful book. I was speaking to Anne about it yesterday, saying that in so many ways it is timeless, but in so many other ways it is just so timely. Anne, thank you so much for writing it, and thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much. Thank you all for being here. It means so much to me, truly from my heart. Thank you, Nicole. Thank you.